But again, back to, you know, your business model of the hairdresser and the farmer, I want to make sure that they get the best product. I know how to use the blemished tomato, and I can use that. And all of a sudden, when we have, you know, 30 extra pounds of mushrooms at the warehouse, well, guess what's on Braze's menu that week? We have 3 mushroom dishes. You know what I mean?
Hello, and welcome to Food Crush, the On Milwaukee podcast for people who eat and should use suntan lotion, in my case, because I got sunburnt this past weekend. The annoyed voice you're hearing right now is Matt Miller, pop culture editor at OnMilwaukee.com, and I'm joined by a much smarter person, Lori Frederick, culinary writer, dining expert at OnMilwaukee.com. How are you doing today, Lori?
I'm good, and I'm always liberally slathered with sunscreen, because
yeah, the thing is, I never do that much outdoor stuff in the sun, and then once every year I do it, and I forget how awful it is when you get out of sunscreen.
This is your PSA, sunscreen.
Yeah,
sunscreen is good.
A perfectly timed PSA just for the end of summer, everybody. So remember this, come next May, wear sunscreen, yeah, or be annoyed like me.
And you know who else uses probably a lot of sunscreen? Farmers.
A farmer, yes. Or I was going to say our guest.
Well, our guest too, yeah.
Dave, what's your stance on suntan lotion? Pro or con?
I'm Norwegian, so that is a definite pro.
Yeah. Yes. Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm Norwegian too. You would think that I would have learned some valuable lessons here. Yeah. I have not, it would appear. But what we should learn is who the name of our guest is, yeah, and what he does and where he works.
The thus far anonymous Dave. So, no, we're talking with Dave Swanson of Braze Restaurant Culinary School, restaurant supported agriculture program. And he's got his feet in all sorts of parts of the local food movement, I guess. I guess you'd call it that still.
And important to note, Braze has an awesome food truck that I had at Chill on the Hill a few weeks ago.
Yeah.
And I had a absolutely terrific chorizo and kimchi dish there. And it has been stuck in my head ever since. So I want to thank you for that right off the bat.
Well, sunburn and kimchi, what better combination can you ask for, right?
Should I put the kimchi on my chest?
That probably wouldn't feel very nice.
Does it have healing properties?
From the inside, maybe. Not maybe.
Yeah.
Rubbed on.
Heal the soul, maybe not so much the skin.
So good afternoon, Dave. How are you?
I am well. Thank you both to Matt and Lori for inviting me on.
Yeah. Thanks for joining us. Let's talk a little bit about you. I mean, obviously, you know, you've been a chef for a very, very long time.
Yeah, you're already aging me. But yes, so we established I'm Norwegian and I'm a chef and I have a farmer connection. So yes, those are all true things. I've been cooking since I was like 15, working at small little American restaurant when my sister was a server. She needed, you know, she said, I need a job. So that's what I did in the kitchen. And I never looked back from the food industry from that point on. And so I went to Kendall College when it was in Evanston, Illinois, on the Northwestern campus. And then I trained in a lot of French restaurants. So that's really my bulk of training is, you know, classic French approach. Mm-hmm. And so places like, you know, Le Francais, L'Atelier de Paris, Carlos are all part of the places that I worked at in the near your area. So yeah, that's kind of and then I worked at Sanford for a little over 6 years, and then it brought me to my conceptualization of Braze. So we started in ideally it was supposed to be the restaurant and then the culinary school. I mean, it was supposed to be the restaurant, culinary school, RSA, then home delivery. That was kind of steps, but it turned out to be the RSA first and then home delivery, and then the restaurant culinary school came afterwards, and that was due to the real estate market in 2009, 2010 here.
Yeah, lots of things impact when you can, when it is practical to do what you want to do.
Yes, exactly.
Going back a little, what you said that you really got attached to the food space early on and didn't look back. What was it for you that
Well, early on in the family dynamic, it was my dad always having a farm and my mom always cooking things from scratch, which was very nice. So it got us exposed to a number of things. And my parents were like, okay, you're going to try something, you know, no matter what it is, you at least try it once. So at, you know, 8, 9 years old, eating an artichoke wasn't the top of the list. But it was something that, you know, it's like, okay, you're going to try it and you're going to, you know, at least be exposed to this, which I think is a great thing. You know, I'm not a parent, but I see parents that are, you know, constantly just feeding their kids chicken tenders. And I just question that, especially in my world of food, you know, and it's easier to, you know, to look upon it from an outsider. But, you know, for my experience, I really love doing that and love having those experiences. And that's what I think really kind of put me towards that, you know, my career.
So did you grow up on a farm? I don't think I knew this.
Okay. In Illinois, so I was close enough to some farms. Really close to the Wisconsin border. So it was always something that we shopped at farmers markets. You know, my dad had a garden back. So it was part of it. But then going through the French system, farms were always a huge part of what a restaurant did. And, you know, we had people that raised our ducks and pheasants and, you know, had our vegetables coming in. So we really had a really close connection with who was growing our food. And I remember one story where there was one time a farmer came in, dropped some stuff off at Le Francais, and one of the cooks just kind of nonchalantly just kind of tossed the bag of vegetables into the cooler. And the farmer didn't like that because he's damaging the product. So the farmer gathered everything up and took all the stuff back home to the farm. And so the chef had to go to apologize to the farmer and say, I will train my cooks better to treat your products better than that. And so to me, that was a really bring it home moment where, okay, there is a different thing here of, you know, just that, you know, obviously the taste is one thing, but there's a different connection here. And what they have with their food than what we have here in America with our food.
Sure. Well, and essentially, I mean, it's like anything else. You know, you go to a hairdresser and they want to cut your hair, you know, because you're essentially a walking advertisement for them. And I would imagine it's very similar with a farmer in that they're producing, you know, they're working really hard producing a product that's going on a menu and they want that product to be showcased as best it possibly can, you know.
So. Exactly.
Like any business. I don't think we think of hairdressers and, you know, and farmers in the same
sentence. Well, I don't know, Matt.
Ever,
I mean, I think of hairdressers, you know, in the same vein that you do, you know?
Yeah, this is true, Laura. This is true. Our hairstyling needs are minimal.
That is true.
Have you seen the Zoom call right now?
So let's talk for people who don't know, like the restaurant piece of what you do. And the Braised Restaurant's connection to the farms, you know, that seems natural. The culinary school aspect, you know, I think we can imagine that to a great extent. But the concept of an RSA, or a restaurant-supported agriculture program, talk a little bit about that, because that was an idea you had and kind of really based on need, which maybe is surprising, you know, because we're surrounded by farms in Wisconsin. But there were issues early on kind of getting that food to folks,
There still is. There's two main really points of the RSA and things that are still not yet, you know, answered. One is, how do we get food from point A to point B? And two is food security. And both of those have not been answered. Even though we're, you know, now with the RSA, I mean, we are 14 years into it. And so it's still, you know, it's still an ongoing thing. But the idea behind it was, I wanted to do a restaurant that just paid more than just, you know, putting a farm name on a menu or carrying a little red wagon of produce back to the restaurant. And I worked at restaurants where, you know, they bought from broadline purveyors for most of the stuff, and they just bought, you know, $100 or $200 worth of, you know, farm stuff from the farmer's market, and that was it. And then people touted them as, you know, local green restaurants. Okay, great. I wanted to do more than that. And so when you start putting down what a small restaurant, you know, 100 seats, serving just dinner five nights a week, what amount of product you need for that, it's a lot. It's more than what you can fit in a Little Red Wagon. If I was to bring my Little Red Wagon back on a Saturday night, open doors at 5 o'clock, by 5:45, I'd be out of that food. And so that's not realistic. It's romantic, but not realistic. So you have to talk about 10,000 pounds of kohlrabi, you know, 15,000 pounds of carrots, stuff like that on that kind of level. And to do that, you need trucks to bring stuff point A to point B, people to do that, and you need storage facilities to do that. And those are all things that we have done things in different evolutions along the way. And again, we haven't fully answered those questions, and it changes. And I don't know when Milwaukee will be able to answer those questions.
So years and years ago, probably, I guess, in maybe the mid-2000s, you know, if you were getting fresh produce from farms, you were picking it up at the farm.
Yep.
Or that farmer was leaving it somewhere for you. You know, I know a lot of chefs.
You were,
you know,
doing a nefarious exchange at a park and ride somewhere and opening the trunks up. Yeah. And switching,
it was basically, you know, this is the scene from All the President's Men, yes, with Deep Throat. Yep.
The black market vegetables. Yes. Right.
Yeah. I mean, that was the interaction between, you know, I've had, you know, cheese delivered out of the Cadillac for, you know, whole wheels of cheese. You know, it's like, that is the infrastructure that is set in think about what Wisconsin is, agricultural state. And that is the reality of this. And
now you have farmers who have maybe a few more clients, you know, restaurants that they might, yep, sell to. So maybe they, you know, invested in a vehicle and they drive produce down and deliver it once a week, yeah, to those places. But that's another addition, you know, that farmers weren't necessarily equipped with. And in your case, you were starting a restaurant. You wanted to do more with local. And so did the RSA spring out of the idea that, okay, we're already doing this, why don't we, you know, let some other restaurants get in on this idea?
Yeah, you know? I mean, it wasn't, I did not invent local food. I did not invent.
Thank you.
Yeah. just to clarify between us, you know,
you're not that old.
Yeah. And I didn't, you know, it's one of those things where what I wanted to do, and I know other chefs wanted to do it as well. And so when you start looking at how to make, you know, obviously buying $100, $200 worth from a farmer's market, that's easy to balance the books on if your sales are $800,000. That's a, you know, a drop in the bucket. But when you start looking at buying things on grander scales, it requires, you know, looking at what food cost is and what cost of goods are sold, and looking at, okay, we got to change our whole dynamic, because buying a bag of flour from a broadline purveyor at $10, $12, you know, a bag, now we're buying it at $60 for the same amount. That's an incredible difference in price structure. And to do that, you have to figure out, how do we make that price structure a little more level playing field? And that's when I, you know, like, just volume. So if I want carrots and I can get 10 other restaurants that want carrots, now we're talking not giving me 200 pounds of carrots, but now we're talking about getting 10,000 pounds of carrots. And now we can guarantee the farmer has a sale. We can guarantee the restaurants have product. And now we can say, which is on both ends, like, that $2 a pound carrot that you see at a farmer's market, out of the reach for a restaurant affording that, now it can be down to $1.25, which is good for the restaurant. And on that kind of scale for the farmer, it's good for the farmer. And so, sure, now you have, it's an equation on both sides that works. Whereas in the food system, where it's always a race to the bottom line for farmers to grow corn cheaper and soybean cheaper. So you have to do that by just massive amounts. And all it is like, okay, how do we save 1 cent? Or how do we, you know, now we got to farm the same amount, but now we got to, rather than getting 32 cents a pound or 32 cents a ton for it, now we got to get 31 cents a ton for it. And I never wanted to be a race to the bottom. I always wanted to be, you know, equitable on both sides.
Sure. So in some way, I mean, so this is ideally a really, really good deal for both the farmer who, in some cases, might sell most or all of something, you know, to a restaurant or a group of restaurants. Yes.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
You know, I mean, if we say, hey, we have enough people here, we can buy your entire carrot crop for the year.
Yeah. I mean, there are farmers. Yeah, there are farmers on different levels. There are CSA farmers that grow for the CSA. And then they are, you know, if they have 100 members and they are going to put one tomato in the box, they need 100 tomatoes. They're not going to grow 100 tomatoes. They're going to grow 150 tomatoes and take the 100 best tomatoes. We can come and take those other 50 tomatoes that are a little bit blemished and use it at the restaurant because now we can process that. Whereas a CSA, they want a perfect heirloom ripened tomato.
Right.
And the farmers need to have to grow extra to allow for that, which is how we shop at a grocery store. It's all about eye appeal.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what are the links? So are you guys picking up produce? Are farmers still bringing it down? Is it a combination? Because what's missing is kind of like a food hub, so to speak, right?
Yep.
Where the delivery channels, like everybody can, there's all sorts of entities picking up food in one place.
Yeah. And we try to do that. And it's incredibly difficult to do that. And we worked with partners like Feeding America to do that, where they have cold storage, they have freezer storage, they have dry storage, and we can cross stock with them and bring stuff in. There are very few farmers that, you know, when a farmer has the ability to deliver stuff to a urban center like Milwaukee, they're doing it on scale that they're selling to grocery stores and they're selling to multiple, and they're bringing in, you know, an 18-foot box truck to do that. And there are very few farms that can do that.
Sure.
Other farms are delivering in the back of their Subaru, their Honda Civic, their, you know, whatever it is. And on that kind of scale, it's harder for them to do that. And so it is a combination of us going out there, and we try to do spots where we pick up in an area on a Monday, pick up in another area on a Tuesday, because we can bring our refrigerated Sprinter van and go pick up from six farms in one loop, and it makes it easier. And we do small things where we have small hubs and areas. So farmers in a northern area can drop at one farm, and we can pick up at a certain time frame from six or seven farms at one drop. So the farmer is now delivering 12 miles away rather than 48 miles away, which makes it a lot of sense because now they can be in the field where that's where farmers make money, not in the back of their, or in the car, delivering a couple cases to a restaurant.
Sure. So the goal is to bring some efficiency to that, to allow people better access, good pricing, and so forth on local food. I mean, it really, really quite simple, but you need a more complex, you know, but there's a lot of farms and a lot of
And there's some things that just like, you know, like when we deliver things to outpost stores, we deliver green beans and asparagus, and sometimes they are not where those farms are located. They're not close to the hubs that we have. So they're dropping off to, you know, to us directly, and we will, you know, park one truck and park another truck and then unload from one truck to another truck. And then we go out and deliver to the four outpost stores here in the Milwaukee area. So it's a very interesting thing to look at. And you have to dig deep down into understanding local food, understanding every farmer's not the same thing. There are farmers that are just growing things on contract. There are farmers that are doing a CSA. There are farmers that are a CSA farmers market. There are farmers only. There are farmers going farmers markets. So a farmer is not a farmer is not a farmer. And our thing is looking at the RSA thing, the BRACE thing is looking at small and medium scale farmers. And again, back to the food security thing that we started this conversation with. How do we protect those farms? Because when we started 14 years ago, you know, you look at some of the farms we worked with, some are not in business anymore.
Sure.
And that food security is dwindling. I mean, look on the grander scale of, you know, the nation in whole and how many farms go out of business each year. And then other farms have to pick up for that lack of production by increasing in size, increasing in efficiency, and drilling down to now then competing for cents on the ton of product they have to grow. And that just puts enormous pressure on them to do that.
Yeah.
And that's not going to feed the whole, you know, the RSA is not going to feed the whole country. And that's not what it was for. It was for me to do restaurants and me to understand other chefs like myself, independent restaurants, just want to have a foot in the door to allow for easier access.
Yeah. Yeah. And this has worked in a variety of ways. I know that, you know, there's some restaurants who started out, you know, going through you and they got familiar, you know, with things and made connections with some farms and have worked out, you know, their own arrangements, which, you know, at least from my angle, like that's not a terrible, terrible thing, you know, because the more people that you have doing, you know, doing more things, maybe the better.
It's something that, it's a hard thing because then you're getting away from the idea of trying to be efficient with the farmer, because rather than the farmer dropping off to one, now he's dropping off to six places, and now something that takes an hour and a half now has taken 3.5 hours.
Sure.
And that's what a lot of restaurateurs or, you know, any kind of business, some business people don't look at. And unfortunately, you know, it's more about, you know, some don't want to work with the RSA because it's run by a chef at another restaurant in the same area that their restaurant is in. It's also, you know, adds a little cost to, you know, to the vegetable that they can get directly from another farm.
Mm-hmm.
So rather than paying 4 cents more for a holistic approach, they'd rather get that 4 cents, save that 4 cents and have the farmer then spend more money to do the same things. You know, and the farmer's putting the bill on their, because a lot of farmers, you ask them what they're charging for delivery. They're not. They're not charging for their gas. They're not charging for their time. They're not charging for the wear and tear on their vehicle. And if they did those three things, great. Do it. But your vegetables are going to be more money, and then the farmers are afraid that the restaurants then will go buy elsewhere. Mm. And a lot will.
Yeah. So it's complicated. And in a really good world, the farmer is taking all those things into consideration. So they are at least not losing.
Yeah.
Losing on the cost of their product.
Well, then they get to the point where 8 years down the road, they're like, oh, my Subaru now broke down. I got to replace it, but I have no money to replace it because I never charged anybody along the way to replace that vehicle. Now, how do I get my vegetables back to these restaurants that want the vegetables? Right. The restaurants, some restaurants don't care. They'll just be like, okay, you don't have heirloom tomatoes this week. Well, I got three other farmers that have heirloom tomatoes this week. I'll get it from them.
Mm.
And then what does that do? It doesn't get us anywhere we want to be. And like I said before, distribution is one thing, but food security is, I mean, it really encompasses a lot. And you can talk about food security on a number of different levels, especially with after COVID, which, you know,
makes a lot of sense. Well, and when you talk about food security, often you're talking about food security for, like, for human beings and access to food. But it bleeds into this bigger picture of, like, the local food world where you know, growing the things, you know, and having people growing and producing the things in a local area, you know.
Yeah,
it feeds the people around it. You know, we have a big, beautiful state full of lots of land that can be farmed, but you need the people to farm that, and you need to be able to get that.
Creating a sustainable system for both. And sometimes it's a system that created for restaurateurs to take advantage of the farmers. And I always looked at it as to be like, okay, if we took our, you know, fresh flour budget and nixed that and don't do fresh flowers on the tables, but put that money to buying better vegetables, great. Okay, let's look at other things that we can do in the restaurant. Well, we don't need to have white tablecloths on every table. We can just do our regular base tables. We don't have to worry about that. So there's things that we took out our cost of goods on other areas to add to our pile to push into local products and local meats and local vegetables and spend more on that. And that is how I view it. And other restaurants don't view it that way. And that's fine. And that's to each their own. And this is how I view it. This is how a system that I think is equitable for both sides, and it has worked. We have restaurant partners that have been with us since day one, and we're still working with them to this day. And we have changed a little bit, especially in the time frame that we, you know, are talking about this. I mean, we launched a nonprofit a couple of years ago, and what I like to do with RSA is push that underneath that nonprofit umbrella, because part of the issues we have is RSA people think, you know, it's hard for them to want to work with a for-profit, especially with another restaurateur leading another chef leading that process. Yeah.
Because it feels counterintuitive in some respects. You feel like, okay, well, I'm buying product from another restaurant. And we go
through these things where they think I'm getting the best product and they're getting the secondary product. But again, back to, you know, to your business model of the hairdresser and the farmer, I want to make sure that they get the best product. I know how to use the blemished tomato and I can use that. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden when we have, you know, 30 extra pounds of mushrooms at the warehouse, well, guess what's on Braze's menu that week? We have three mushroom dishes. Yes. You know what I mean? Yes. And for lack of a better term, I always say this, and, you know, gentleman that ran the RSA for me, with me for a while, Jeff, he was just like, I coined it bottom feeder. Braze is the bottom feeder of the RSA. We take all that stuff that just has to move and has to get through, and the kohlrabi that restaurants wanted to buy but then didn't buy, then there's extra that we have to use, and we use it, and, you know, we had kohlrabi curry on our menu for the opening week of the restaurant because we had extra curry, extra kohlrabi that was available. So that's how those things work.
And that was delicious, though, that kohlrabi curry.
Of course, yeah, it should be delicious.
Well, no, but you also built a restaurant that was big enough, at least at the time. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know how this works on the long term, but that, you know, you built in this idea that you were going to preserve things. You know, you needed storage for that.
Yes.
You know,
yeah.
Not every single, like I think, you know, your thought process in creating Braze, you know, you made sure you had space so that you guys could be local all year, you know?
Yeah.
And that takes a lot more, you know, in talking to people, you know, some of the spots that have tiny little spaces, you know, like, yeah, I would love to preserve things. Where am I going to put it?
Yeah.
You know,
when you go to school and you look at how to run a restaurant, your square footage of your kitchen should be 30% of your square footage, you know, in comparative to your dining room. Mm. Ours is 65%. Mm-hmm. So we have a huge kitchen comparatively to our dining room space. And that is to break down whole animals. That is to preserve. That is to take vegetables that are not in a Sysco pouch, but that's to wash them and take the tops off and use the greens from the carrots, use the greens from the kohlrabi and the beets and stuff like that. And we have to wash them in containers because they don't come in a sealed, hermetically sealed bag and clip it open and warm it up in a microwave, put it on a plate. We don't do that. And so the kitchen has to be big to allow for that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And that, but that also makes it easier, a little bit easier. I mean, you still need the manpower, but to use up, you know, things that need to be used up, whether they're, you know, pickled or frozen or,
yeah,
you know, I mean, on the menu or whatnot.
Food preservation has always been the linchpin of local food, how to make it work. And especially in a, you know, an area like Wisconsin that has four seasons.
Yes. Yeah.
Four seasons.
Because we don't.
Yeah.
Well, we do.
Well, one season is just really, really short. So that,
and kind of about the equivalent of one day of spring you know?
Every year. We have that one day of spring and we have that week of fall.
Yep. Oh,
but that's a gorgeous week,
fall
though.
Fall lasts longer, actually.
What a week it is, though.
Yeah,
what
exactly.
A week it is.
This episode of Food Crush is brought to you by the Wisconsin Restaurant Cookbook, a collection of over 40 mouthwatering recipes from Wisconsin chefs. All proceeds will support grants for Wisconsin restaurants, so you can eat better while supporting a great cause. Pick up your copy of the Wisconsin Restaurant Cookbook at a Pick and Save or Metro Market store near you. For more information, visit pickandsave.com/cookbook. So, but getting back to some of this, so we were talking about farms, you know, some farms have disappeared, you know. Yeah. And I know years ago we used to talk about how the age of the average farmer, you know, was pretty old, you know, and people's kids weren't taking over farms. Now I think we're seeing a lot of young farms, younger farmers, you know, farmers that maybe don't fit that traditional older family farm model. But what's happening to farms now? I mean, is that still a little bit of the issue? Are there other issues? I mean, over the course of the pandemic, I'm sure new issues have arisen. So what does that look like?
It's still the same issue. It's there are younger farmers, but not on the scale to offset older farmers retiring and leaving from the food production arena. Okay. There's another very successful CSA farm here that I was just talking to the wife, and she's just like, my kids don't want to take over the farm. It's a pretty big operation, and they have, you know, many, you know, arms of the farm, and they do preserving and things of that nature. And she's like, oh, we can't get our kids to do it. And there are some people that are in the food, and think about people in the food business, that they tell their children not to go in the food business.
Right.
And, you know, they don't, because
it's hard.
You know, the heirs don't understand what that is. But farmer kids understand what that is. And they're shocked by it because they see mom and dad working 18 hours a day in the field, not being able to go on vacation, not being able to, you know, afford health insurance. And there's like, no, I want to go to college. And not saying that farmers are not college educated. That's not what I mean. But they're just like, I want to find a way other than what mom and dad at the farm have done.
Yeah. It's hard work. It is not to, you know, do the farm romanticizing, you know, stereotypes, but it is, like you said, it is long hours. It is hard, laborious work. And like you said, the kids see that and they're like, why would I want to do this? Why would I not want to
They see things, especially, I mean, with technology, how it makes our lives easier on a number of levels. And they see it like, oh, I can go do this, make much more money, and I can go out with my friends, and I can afford things that I like to do.
How much of it is also the kind of mega farms and like those, like the giant kind of conglomerate farms pushing these small farms up, making life even harder for them? Is that a component of things?
You know, so what Braze does and how we work with farmers, and you look at things nationally, what happens with prices on ingredients or, you know, some kind of like if salmonella breaks out in, you know, spinach out in California.
Or if we have a chicken shortage like we've had.
Yeah. I mean, that stuff really has no bearing on what we do internally. We're somewhat isolated by it.
That's kind of nice, I imagine.
It is. But there's a ceiling to that isolation, that if we get to production where, let's say half of all restaurants in Wisconsin want to do what Braze does, we would run into issues then, because then the production is not there from small and medium farms to do that. Then we'd have to run into that ceiling with working with these bigger conglomerate farms that, okay, are not going to be doing the same things that the small mom and pop are doing in relationship to sustainable growing practices. That's when there'll be a huge paradigm shift in a real fight with the bigger farms and how, you know, monoculture farms work with businesses now. And but we're not there yet, you know.
Okay.
I hope we get to that point where.
It sounds like a good thing, because if more places are doing what you're doing, that's a good thing for the environment and for, you know, sustainability. But at the same time, like you were saying, if it runs into that situation where these small farms can't keep up with the kind of expectations, well then, like you said, that's where the ceiling, and hopefully it's a glass ceiling that can be broken. But if I'm hearing this right.
Well, and it's interesting because, and I'll just from another side of this, I was on the Outpost board, you know, for 7 years, and they went from a model, because they'd buy directly, you know, from a good number of farms in Wisconsin. And it got to the point where even, you know, Outpost now has 4 stores and demand, you know, because people shop at those stores because they're like, mm-hmm. hey, aside from the farmer's market, this is where I go to buy, you know, local produce. And, you know, they ran into issues where they're like, okay, these little farms don't have enough produce. Like, yeah. we could buy all yeah. of their produce and not stock all 4 of our stores. So what they went to is a model where you are going to find different things from different farms at each of the stores. Like, so if you're a crazy person and you really want to get the full complement of what they offer, you'd really have to take a trip to all the stores. But instead of not supporting the small farmers because they weren't big enough, they said, hey, so the Bayview store is going to carry from these farms. We'll buy all of the stuff and put it there. You know, we'll buy some from the others. Now, not every grocer is flexible enough, really, able to say, hey, you know, they're looking for consistency. So they're like, well, hey, if you can't supply to all of our stores or if you can't give us all of this, we don't want any of it.
And have the consumer base that understands that process. Because, I mean, I know Aldi is different from Outpost, but people are always like, listen, you can't go to Aldi with a shopping list. Like, you have to kind of go there.
Because you never know. Yeah,
exactly, yeah. And so it has to, your consumer base, like the customer base at Outpost kind of has that idea of like, this is small farms. This isn't going to be like everything all the time, always at my fingertips.
And they've
Whereas
done a pretty good job.
Your average pick and save shopper is like, where's all the things I want now?
Yeah, and you could equate that to the restaurants where if somebody likes AZ Farms, you know, beets, well, they might only have it for a week and a half on our menu. Mm-hmm. But if they like from a bigger farm, the beets from that bigger farm, well, they might be on our menu for 2.5 months because mm-hmm. just one farm can provide 200 pounds. The other farm can provide 2,000 pounds. Mm, so sure. then, you know, that window is kind of the, you know, shopping at the BV Outpost. And, you know, you can equate those two things with how restaurants work with, you know, smaller, how we work with a small farm.
And you would hope that you have the customer base that understands how the system works, where it's like, oh, where's that dish I loved? And it's like, oh, this is how this works. As opposed to, like, you see some of these poor restaurants with, like, we've had the chicken shortage and the supply issues, and are just like, yeah, we don't have the meat shortages that we had last year.
Which are really about global, like, which, I mean, those are problems that stem from not getting chickens from China, which is,
you feel bad for these places though, because like these people are like, why are my wings this expensive now? Or like, and it's just like, you have to understand this one restaurant is all a part of a web of everything. Like,
we have educated consumers that know, like, when they get from this farm, these beets taste differently from other farms because their soil is different. They're not in a glacier scraped area. They have more mineral content, or they're in this really, you know, loamy soil that the beets taste differently, grown in hard rocky soil and very, you know, heavy topsoil, loamy soil that just gives the beets a different flavor. And so our guests could know the difference between beets from one farm to another farm, which is good to see. Not everybody, but I mean, that's...
that's pretty cool.
Yeah, it is cool.
Yeah.
I show up and I'm just like, it's a beet.
Yeah. And that's fine. As long as you can tell a beet from, you know, potato chip, we like that.
I'm pretty pumped when I'm like, it's a really good start. I'm just super pumped you said kohlrabi, and I was like, I know what that is.
I know what that is. That's good. This weekend. And that's where, like, for us, education is hugely important. Because we started working with CSA farmers on what was in their box, and people would not identify what a kohlrabi is. And that's how, like, we thought the culinary school was very important to local food, because it taught people about what things are and what local food is.
And what do you do with those things? How can you do it?
Because if you're growing kohlrabi and you're growing so much that you're going to be consuming it 8 months out of the year, you better have more than one dish in your repertoire, other you're going to have a revolt of your family on your hands.
I was going to say, and it goes back to that thing we talk about a lot, Lori, where, you know, the media informing the public of these things, and like the growth of, you know, the Food Network, and the growth of food shows on YouTube and things like that have gotten people interested and excited to try things like that over the past few decades, where it's like, it's no longer, people are excited to try kind of these unique ingredients and mm-hmm. things that they may not have heard of before, but they've seen on these shows. I think that that's obviously contributed
well,
a lot,
and,
too.
And that has definitely helped on the restaurant front, you know, because mm-hmm. not everybody is necessarily going to know what to do with them themselves, but they at least, you know, are willing to eat them. But even for me, you know, I think that farmers markets and, you know, I had a CSA for quite a long time, and the unpredictability, CSAs are really flexible now often. Like you can say, oh, I don't eat tomatoes. Don't send me tomatoes. Or, you know, some of the farms have gotten flexible because they found customers who don't know what to do with them. But back when I did it, it was, you know, what came in your box every week was what was fresh and what was new. And I you know, I would get things that I was like, oh, maybe I'd heard of it. Maybe I hadn't. But I was like, you know, maybe it's Jerusalem artichokes. What do I do with these? You know, well, it's that was the most fun I ever had, really, discovering how to do new things, you know, with cool new foods. And I guess I have farms to blame for that. But it, in the long run, you know, it helped me. It helped me as I was moving into writing about restaurants, you know, because I knew it all those what those things were. And I knew what they tasted like.
And CSA farmers have evolved. There was, you mm-hmm. know, one of our programs that we had early on with RSA was a home delivery program, delivering these products mm-hmm. to people's homes. Now there are many players in that arena, and some of our CSA farmers are doing that. So we mm-hmm. jettisoned that program. We don't do the home delivery anymore because, you know, we shown the farmers that, hey, here's a viable solution mm-hmm. for if you're able to, you know, deliver stuff to people's doors, they are willing to buy it and pay a premium price for that, which is great. Yeah. So there are some farmers like Lotfaddle, Tim at Lotfaddle's doing a home delivery program. So if they're doing it, then we don't have to do it. We can show them, you know, here's a system that does work. Now go and run with it. And hopefully that can make your farm, you know,
well,
more sustainable.
And farms need, you know, someone I was chatting with, we chatted with Christine Hansen, and she just wrote a book on Wisconsin farms, like features that have become like agritourism kind of thing. So like the pizza farms and, you know, everything from pizza farms to farmers markets to, you know, the places that have set up, you know, Airbnbs on their farm where people can stay and kind of see the farm in action. And, you know, we were talking about how all of that has stemmed from, you know, maybe farmers are looking for something fun to do, you know, in some of these cases. But it also, you know, everybody needs a new revenue source. You know, I mean, farmers don't make a ton of money. You know, you talk about restaurants. You know, restaurants, the model is not built to, you know, for people to make bazillions of dollars unless they have, you know, many locations of a restaurant, you know, unless you build a chain. So this idea of all of these cool things, you know, being another revenue source, you know. And over the years, I think some farms have found that revenue source in restaurants, you know, where they're growing crops that they may not have grown before because there's a demand with the restaurant market.
Doing that and selling to producers or processors to make a value-added product, making a salsa that is shelf stable that they can sell year round, selling their tomatoes and using a tomato sauce to sell year round, and that's always been the linchpin of local food. How do we make it work when the strawberry season is 2 weeks long? You know, how do we make that work at that point in time? Because there are a lot, you know, there are your A's, there's your B's, there's your C's, and a lot of people are not going to come and buy your C's at the farmer's market or come, you know, when you go mm-hmm. pick strawberry farm, you're not picking the C's off the vine, you're picking the A's. But where are the B's and C's going? And that's where B's can go to restaurants to make, you know, sauces and strawberry shortcakes and whatnot. And then the C's can be used, you know, in the food industry to create, you know, jams and jellies, and that's where a lot of value-added products can help the farmer, and that's diversification mm-hmm. that really makes the farmers, you know. And other diversifications that we do is just farm dinners, going out to the mm-hmm. farm and doing a dinner out there. It mm-hmm. puts money in the farmer's wallet to showcase their farm, and something that they probably did not put in their business model of here's a farmer's market, here's the CSA. Oh, now I can actually showcase my farm and sell some stuff and make money on bringing people out to my farm and eating my vegetables prepared by a chef.
Yeah. Well, and 30 years ago, you know, if you had a farm, you didn't have a CSA. I don't think, you know, CSA has kind of cropped up more recently.
Yeah. In the late 70s.
You know, I mean, farmers always had like farm stands or went to farmers markets. You know, CSAs are new. And, you know, now I think you're just seeing everybody get really, really creative. And if they're not getting creative, I think they're probably suffering on some level because farming has changed a lot, like everything else. You and I were talking a little bit about the pandemic and how it has impacted, how staffing issues, you know, are going as far as farms. What does that sort of look like? You know, I think you talked about, and you broke the sad news to me that, is it Lonesome Mills?
Lonesome Stone.
And they had, you know, and they were using, you know, local grains and had a mill. What was the story on that? Like, was that a product of the pandemic that they closed, or is that another factor?
I think that was the, you know, kind of the last nail in the coffin, so to speak. You know, it's hard to do those things, you know, that especially, you know, growing flour. I mean, growing grains for flour and producing flour and milling flour. Mm-hmm. You know, so like for our bread program at Braze, we have now, for 10 years, we have made our own bread in the restaurant. And now this is the first year we're not, because there are three out of the four mills that we buy from have either went out of business or changed their model. Whether they're growing grains for the distillery business, whether they're changing the amount that they grow for a minimum order. So it's a full pallet ton of flour that we cannot use up in the time frame before that flour goes to waste. So there are some sad stories in regards to, you know, what has happened. And other farms, you know, CSA farmers are, you know, downsizing. They're just going to, you know, trying to create that balance of life, which I think COVID has taught a lot of people, you know, what is important. And so a lot of farms have, you know, downsizing their CSA and just trying to say, like, okay, I used to have 8 farmhands helping me do this. Now I only have 4. What can we do? You know, what can the, you know, can we do a farm store? You know, can we, how much field items can we grow? So they're, you know, they're changing the amount of varieties they grow. They're changing the quantity that they grow just to make sure that the 50% that they have of labor is, you know, is able to do the things they want to do. And so those are interesting things that are just coming out of, you know, COVID and how some farms are, you know, not being able to pick all the produce on their, you know, speaking of strawberries, we talk about that, but there's, you know, farms that have strawberries rotting in the field because they don't have enough people to come and pick them. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We don't have enough, you know, some farmers
and do you sell that, you know, if you don't have the infrastructure, you can't just decide, oh,
Yeah, I mean, they can't. Well, they're not set up for a U-pick. They're just
right,
not. They
don't
not
have infrastructure
intended.
For it.
Correct.
Right.
And that requires a lot of other things, insurance, and have people on your land, and all that kind of stuff. Which just they can't.
So it's not like you can just flip over and do that. Which would be the ideal scenario, right? Like, oh, you can.
Yeah.
We don't have pickers, so you can pick your own.
Exactly, and people don't know that, and that's why it's a sad thing, because then we just have quantity issues. Like, it's not that we can't, you know, like if we want X amount of products where we would order from our farmer to get that delivered, you know, or picked up next week. Now it might take us 2 weeks because we can't pick 200 pounds of X product this week, but we can pick 100 pounds this week, we can pick 100 pounds next week. And they have to division of labor to make that work for us, which is very interesting. So there are things that we have to do to make, you know, to make it work on our menu and to make it work on what we're trying to do. And, you know, if we're not be able to get flour in and showcase local flour like we did for 10 years, then we have to change that program as well, because there's no sense of producing our own breads if we're going to be using the same flour that, you know, multi-generation companies are doing, you know, the you know, the broadline purveyors that I'm speaking of.
Well, and when your business is built on the model of, okay, we're going to support local, you have to be flexible, you know, because different growing seasons, you know, when places flood, you know, there may not be a crop that we were really hoping to put on the menu or to deliver to people, you know. Like you said, I mean, there may not be as much money or demand or such, you know, for locally milled flour. And then, or the market changes, you know, and that farmer says, hey, I'm going to grow malt, you know, I'm going to grow something for a brewery instead of, you know, for consumers.
Yeah, it's always something because when people think it's the same thing year in and year out, and all of a sudden the heirloom tomato supply because of, you know, a bug infestation is a quarter of what it was. And they're looking at, oh, you used to have six or seven items on your menu featuring the heirloom tomato. And at that point in time, it's like, now you have one. It's like, okay, well, we just don't have the heirloom tomatoes. And that's just not anybody's fault, you know. It's the Mother Nature decided that year, not so much.
But that also tells a story of the year and the weather, you know, and I guess the landscape too, you know, when you are dependent upon.
Yeah, those and I think that is it is enriching as far as some aspects of what I do in the restaurant, but it also is. Very taxing as well because it requires a lot of planning and a lot of, you know, laid plans that have now changed at the last minute.
And and definitely creativity. I mean, I remember dishes on the braise menu, you know, and sometimes in the winter and it was like carrots three ways. And you know, that, you know, as much as someone might look at that and go, carrots three ways, why would I, you know, it was delicious. But, you know, it was also the product of, hey, look, we have so many carrots, you know.
We have 4,000 pounds of carrots. So
we wouldn't have planned to make you eat carrots three ways, you know, but now we do.
And Lori's eyesight had never been better after that meal.
right. So kind of like, what do things look like? And are these times more challenging for farmers? Than they have been in the past? Or are they?
Yeah. I mean,
you know, better, worse, it's never, otherwise?
Yeah, it's never a straight line continuum. There's always these ebbs and flows. Obviously, you know, a pandemic shift like COVID is not, anybody might didn't plan that, but there's some good things that can come about it. And maybe people rethink how they want to interact with their farm and how they want to, and what things they want to do and what kind of creative ideas they can do by putting a farmer's market, you know, at their farm rather than going to a farmer's market and spending the money to do that. So there are, you know, some good things that'll come from it. How that will affect and shake out, you know, it'll just ebb and flow. I don't know how it all will, wash out. But I know that we have to be a little more nimble than we were in years past because we just don't have the quantities that we can work with in years past just because of one of some of the farmers growing different, you know, smaller amounts. You know, the amount of varieties, rather than growing eight different peppers, they're growing three this year. So we might have the specialty peppers that we had in years past. So that might, you know, that's going to affect some of the things that we can do. There's just, you know, what will it do for the next generation of farmers? Hopefully it doesn't scare more off than what has in the past. And hopefully that doesn't, you know, uptick in more farmers, you know, leaving the industry. I mean, we see a lot of food service people leaving the industry. And I'm sure, you know, that is kind of what is going on in the industry is, you know, the hard work, the long hours, the nights, the weekends, the holidays. And farmers are faced with those same things. So hopefully it doesn't, you know, create a huge void. But if we have more restaurants that are just, you know, writing menus, daily menus, and working with farmers directly, I think that can only help. And then using that creative power on both sides of the equation to help figure out how to navigate this scenario.
Yeah, I feel like restaurants and farms operate on a very similar basis in that most, you know, they're both A, romanticized, you know, for a while, Food Network made everyone want to become a chef because that looks cool, right? For a while, yeah, you know, you have these idyllic farm scenes and people are like, oh, I would love to spend the day with the cute little goats, you know, and, you know, that romanticizing that. But both are really hard work and both are best for a person who just really has a passion for that work. Like, I don't think, you know, you start a farm and you don't like to be outside, you know, or you don't like getting dirty.
You don't wear sunscreen.
You're not going to be a very happy farmer, you know. And I often wonder if things like this weed out the people who aren't made for it, you know, in some respects. Or if, you know, and the pandemic also, I think there's some people who are saying, hey, listen, I burned myself out. I'm going to take a break. And maybe they'll come back. You know, maybe it wasn't a lack of passion. It's just I'm going to go do something else for a minute to clear my head, you know, and maybe they'll come back. But in a sense, it's like those professions will attract people who feel more strongly about it, I think. Because it's hard, you know, and when you have choices and you're choosing it, it's very different.
I think that's part of what's happening in the industry now is, you know, just seeing people are reevaluating what they want to do and how they want to interact with their work life. And technology obviously helps, you know. When I was learning to be a cook, you know, if we wanted to know what was on another restaurant's menu, we either had to go and pay for the food and go sit down at the restaurant, or we had to go work at that restaurant for free. We could not go on their website and download their menu and then look at a YouTube video on how to make something, how do we make a sous vide or something like that. How to make a sous vide is like, we had to learn that from, you know, our chef mentor telling us how to make that, or, you know, reading in, you know, La Russe Gastronomie, how to make that. Now a lot of stuff is at their fingertips to do that. And that's great. It allows a quicker learning curve. But what's missed in that process is just the toil and, you know, you make a sous vide once, okay, you got to do things more than once to be efficient at it. Like, you can watch a video of breaking down a fish, but, you know, do it 100 times. You know, I see guys that are just, you know, 20 years old now. Oh, I broke down a fish. And like, they do it and they like, you left 50% of that meat on the carcass. What I mean, that is not efficient. You're not going to be able to run a restaurant if 50% of the product is still left on the skeleton. It's like, okay, you can't, you know, just because you saw it on YouTube one time, and you may saw somebody doing it very, very wrong on YouTube as well. So it doesn't always equate to that person doing it the right way.
The closest I can come to that, and I'm sure I have like a day-to-day example in writing, but in terms of cooking, was I had to. So I was cooking from the Julia Child cookbook, and I had chosen a special recipe. I was asked by the Journal Sentinel when the Julia Child project, or the movie, the film based on the book, came out.
Yeah, half a good movie.
And they were, you know, they were, and they were supporting or asking people, who bloggers at the time, you know, to cook something difficult, you know, out of that book as part of kind of a series, and then log, you know, take photos and log the experience of that. And I made the mistake of actually picking something that I really had never done, and it was a pâté de canard en croûte. So I had to learn to debone duck.
Yeah.
I'd never deboned a piece of poultry in my life. And I literally, like, I found all sorts of videos. And it turns out that I think Jacques Pepin had a really good deboning video that I watched about 50 times. And then I deboned about 20 chickens because I couldn't afford to practice on that
ducks,
many ducks.
Yes.
But I knew the anatomy was the same. So I had like 15 deboned chickens, which then, like, I made roulades. I made so many fancy
things. So you
things
and Paul
for
ate
guests
chicken
in my
for,
house.
Yeah, for two,
we
two
ate
months
a
straight.
Lot
yeah.
of like beautiful things with deboned chickens. But I mostly did it because I wanted to get it right, because they were sending a photographer to my house specifically to take take photos of me deboning a duck. And I was like, I need to figure this out.
Yeah.
But what it taught me in the end, I mean, I did it for very different reasons, but it did, you know, I learned to debone a piece of poultry. And even though my motivation was different, I found too that like after the fifth duck or the fifth chicken, I was quite a bit better at it. By the 10th chicken, I was pretty good, you know, and by like the 12th chicken, I was like, I don't know. I feel like I actually could whip through, you know, deboning a chicken, you know, with less of my eye open.
Yeah.
Anyway.
And that's what it takes. I mean, and that's where like the French model of doing something for, you know, you start at a restaurant, you do something for a year and you just do that process for a whole year, whether it's breaking down fish and breaking down poultry, breaking down things, then you really learn how to do it and you really learn how to be very good at that. You know, just doing it one time, you know, it's not going to get you there. And so I think that, you know, that technology has, you know, shortened that learning curve. And a lot of times, sometimes to the detriment of the overall industry and the overall craft, because the skill level has diminished a lot.
Because people also think they know or are expert in things that they aren't, you know. Due to that access to information.
Yeah.
Oh no, I lament all the time about things like breakfast places where they either don't have poached eggs, or because no one knows how to poach one, or they don't have very good poached eggs. You know, and there's little things like that where, like poaching an egg, right? It's relatively basic, but there are tricks to it. And it used to be something I feel like everybody knew how to do. And now you walk into places and you're like, oh, no, we don't poach eggs. And you're like, I know why. You have a bunch of kids in the kitchen who don't know how to poach an egg. So, you know, you can't put it on the menu because some days you may have really bad poached eggs. So you'd prefer, you know, to just skip it. That's an interesting thing, you know. And someone was telling me, like, oh, yeah, we just poach our eggs. We just sous vide all of our eggs. Like, we don't poach them anymore. And I'm like, but that's cheating.
Yeah. I mean, sous vide eggs like, is not a poached egg.
You don't know how to. Yeah, you don't know. You don't know actually how to do it. I don't know. My mom drilled it into my head. Like, you had to know how to do everything the real way before you could cheat at it, you know, with a shortcut.
Yay, mom.
You know, my mom. In fact, it was great. She was like, no calculators. You need to learn how to add, subtract, multiply, divide, like on paper before you can do that. And that only came to bite me in the butt when I got to, it was advanced algebra, calculus type things. And I needed a calculator because you cannot do, you know, the algorithms. I mean, on paper.
Yeah.
I suppose you can, but it's not practical, you know, during an exam. And she was like, nope, you got to learn to do it on paper. And I finally had to have the teacher go talk to her and be like, no, she really needs a calculator. So anyway, big fan of learning things the right way. So from a consumer angle, how can people support farming, support farms, you know, are there ways that we can encourage all the good, you know, and I mean, really restaurants that do things right way.
As a human being, we on average eat three times a day and we vote for our food system three times a day. And if you want to change the food system, you're going to have to ask for it. You're going to have to, you know, you're going to have to go out there and vote. Whether it's going to Outpost, whether it's going to a restaurant that supports that, because if you only vote once a week at a restaurant like that, that's not going to be enough votes to make the change. And looking back on, we're going to celebrate our 10th anniversary this December.
Holy cow.
Yeah, I know. But
congratulations.
With that, thank you. Yeah, I thought we would be farther ahead on where the local food movement would have evolved in 10 years. And that just, you know, it's twofold. One is like kind of disheartening, but also two is kind of energetic to know that we have more work to do and we have to figure out what are better ways to bring that message to other people, to get that message out. And not necessarily that what we do at Braze is the end all be all and that's the way things should look. There are other people doing wonderful things and doing creative things and changing how the model is done. How the model is done here in Milwaukee is very different to how it could be done in Madison, Stevens Point, you know, San Diego, California, whatever it is. And it's, I just think that the more people that are engaged in that process and sharing that, and that's the great thing about technology nowadays. We can share those things. I can sit here in my living room and talk to you guys on a podcast and you know, share these things with you guys. And where, you know, a couple of years ago, that wouldn't be a thing, or, you know, COVID has shifted our, you know, our position on how we can share these ideas on a podcast.
Right, right. Well, we would have been, we think about it, and a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, we were sitting in a studio with people.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
You know, and now, you know, we are doing this remotely, and, you know, we had to learn a little bit about a new system, and now it's like, oh, well, this is convenient for people, you know, because you don't have to drive.
Zoom,
you know?
And Skype and all that stuff. It's,
whether we like it or not.
It's both great and a nightmare.
Yes. Yes. More convenient and weirder.
There's,
you know,
always that balance.
Before,
so. Yeah. So, well, I want to thank you. Thank you for what you've been doing. I mean, obviously, you know, there's probably always going to be something and something that needs to, you know, get better.
Oh, yeah.
About, you know, I mean, in part because even if you look at the last couple of years, how much farms have changed, and, you know, as the farms evolve and do different things, I think that all the systems, you know, need to be reworked.
Making farms sexy again, you know, let's bring that back.
Actually, farms never really, you know, they've been idyllic and people have had some crazy notions, but I think we do need to bring, you know, the sexiness back to the farm.
I am not the person to do that, let me tell you right now.
So there won't be commercials with Dave.
No commercials, you know, and,
All right. So, but, well, nonetheless, I mean, definitely thanks for what you do. I mean, and the support
thank
that you,
you.
Give.
I appreciate
and, you know, because if nothing else, I mean, we absolutely need people, you know, who build models, you know, and who find things that work for them. And, you know, I'm sure the farms that you support are grateful to you, and, you know, the people who come and eat the food are grateful.
And for my sake, we need people who make really outstanding chorizo and kimchi dishes at local music festivals.
Right. Right. Well, so
that'll be the end all be all of Braze right there.
There you go. There you go. There you go. When it all crashes down, yep. The food truck will be. Yep. So, no.
Well, thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate the time, and it's been great sharing ideas, and I hopefully people get inspired by, you know, some of the things we talked about today and kind of push a little bit further.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and I'd imagine, I mean, that's part of what makes you come into work every day, right? Like, you're kind of inspired by the farms and the...
That and the mortgage to pay.
Yeah. That's not inspiration, Dave. But yeah, absolutely.
Point of view, Lori, point of view.
Always, always.
Let's call it a podcast. Well, that was an outstanding and informative conversation. So much show. So I shut up during that one. I kind of let you and I. Sometimes I feel very much like today is a day to let the experts talk. Yeah,
you know, and even for me though, I mean, it's complicated. I don't work in that world, you know, direct with farms. I mean, you know, I have a couple of farms that I support on the regular, that I buy from, you know, and try, but like that whole intricate system of how food gets grown and moves from place to place is, you know, kind of above my pay grade sometimes too. So, you know, Dave has his own processes. So, you know, I mean, that's really just a glimpse into the way this works, you know? And I think when you look at it globally, it's this huge, in, you know, web of infrastructures don't necessarily all work.
Yeah,
you know?
And that's what I was saying at the beginning, one part in the middle where it's just like, you know, especially when we were coming out of the pandemic or briefly taking a recess from the pandemic, it was... important to note that it's like, oh, you guys don't have steak right now, or you don't have, or people that restaurants didn't have meat dishes or as many meat dishes during the early pandemic. And then, you know, obviously the chicken wing shortage and stuff like that. It's just like, you have to realize that your restaurant is not an island. Like, it does not exist alone in the world. Like, it also has to coexist with everything else.
And local supply chains aren't much different. You know, like right now, with there's a shortage in the supply of crab. So crab is very expensive. And
glad I had crab cakes last
night. You know, you can't
get
it. Got
my crab cakes at Barnacle Buds just in time.
There you go. So, but local systems, you know, very much reflect the way the big systems work. Although they can be more efficient, I think some of the things, like some of the local places that supported local farms had things, you know, like the places that were buying local chicken had chicken wings. You know, there was a chicken wing shortage on the bigger level.
That's why Wingstop is now Thighstop.
Right. So, you know, it's pretty interesting how that works and how some things are better at the local level and how some things are also still very complicated, even when they don't rely on the more global world. So I don't know. There's a conversation we could probably have 50 times and never really get to the bottom of it. So I'm happy just to have scratched the surface.
Yes.
I
would like to read a food porn with you, Lori.
Oh, I would love to read a food porn with you too.
Yeah, this is going to be the rare joint food porn, which sounds terrible. Our significant others, I apologize.
Yeah, we're not gonna. Yeah, we're still on a video call. We'll just divide it in half. How's that?
Yes, yeah, all I think we'll divide it in half. We're reading a poem by W.D. Earhart, creator of WD-40. No, I'm just kidding. I have no idea about that. And it is a piece.
And cousin of Amelia.
Yes, cousin of Amelia.
No. Not even
relative of
WD-40.
No. He was the creator of WD-27. He wasn't the first WD, but there we got there.
There we go. And all of this, by the way, is lies.
WD Earhart. Our apologies to WD Earhart. We think you're a great person. And we think you're a great poet because we are going to be reading your poem, The Farmer. How weirdly apt. It's almost as though you chose it on purpose, Lori.
Maybe.
Strange. Very strange.
I'm going to let you start.
Okay.
You can read the first half, and I'll read the latter.
Sounds like a deal.
All right.
Here is The Farmer by W.D. Not 40 Earhart. Each day I go into the fields to see what is growing and what remains to be done. It is always the same thing. Nothing is growing. Everything needs to be done. Plow, harrow, disc, water, pray till my bones ache and hands rub blood raw with honest labor. All that grows is the slow, intransigent intensity of need. I have sown my seed on soil guaranteed by poverty to fail.
But I don't complain, except to passers-by who ask me why I work such barren earth. They would not understand me if I stooped to lift a rock and hold it like a child, or laughed, or told them it is their poverty that I labor to relieve. For them, I complain. A farmer of dreams knows how to pretend. A farmer of dreams knows what it means to be patient. Each day, I go into the field.
That's a really good poem. I like that poem. Sad poem. Yeah. In many
it is
ways.
A little sad, and I went back and forth on whether or not, but I think it does, I don't know.
It's a lovely piece of writing, straight up. So I love that.
Yeah.
That was really nice. Lori, you're so good at finding poems.
Thanks.
Remember when these segments were supposed to be stupid and dumb, and then instead you just found really good literature for us to find?
And then I thought for a while, like, how are we going to keep this going? Because I can't find enough stupid, dumb stuff.
Yeah, we ran out of porny things. Sorry. I mean, we didn't run out, but at some point you don't want to read, you know.
Yeah. Well, and at some point you do run out of, like, well-written, slightly sexual
material.
Well,
maybe that would be fun, too. Maybe we need to have a month of trash.
We'll pull a little bit back in here and there as I find it. But there's more really good writing about topics, I think, than there is weird things that you know, and food yeah. porn. I don't know. Food porn is multifaceted. It has a multifaceted meaning.
Like an onion, it has layers. Hey, Lori, where can people find the Food Crush podcast?
Okay, well, you found us. So that part is taken care of. But you can also find us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook, where we try to share, you know, some other content as yeah. well as the podcast.
And so. If you found us on Apple Podcasts, write us a review. Write us a nice little review.
Oh, yeah. That'd if you learn something today.
Hopefully you learned something today. Dave is full of information. So hopefully yeah. you should have learned something. And if you didn't, that's on you.
Yeah. But hopefully you enjoyed. If you did, we want to hear yeah. from you.
Lori,
where
can people find you?
People can find me as well at Milwaukee, where I write about food. Also Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter at Lo Frederick. And how about you?
You can find me at A Man About Film on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. You can't really find me on Instagram. I choose not to be fun. You can find me at Dog Agility Events. And you nice. Can find me writing at unmilwaukee.com.
Yeah. And sometimes eating food with me.
Yeah, that's always we fun. Ate the Glazy Boy at the Wisconsin State Fair.
We did.
Which is surprisingly
good. And we completely smashed the full menu at the new...
You did.
At the new Central Standard.
Oh my God. That menu was delicious. And that venue was gorgeous. And we ate so much freaking food. And
you can actually find those videos at unmilwaukee.com's Facebook page.
I've started jogging now.
How to steal them and post them to the Food Crush page. So
I've determined that I'm now running now. I'm now going for jogs because the past week was not exactly a prime week for Matt eating well. So between State Fair and mukbanging.
Yeah. I ate State Fair foods twice, like once all day, one day. 1 week, and then again all day with you and Steve from TMJ4 this last week. And I'm telling you, I'm not craving a salad per se, but I'm definitely not eating deep fried things right now.
You're thinking a little bit more about a walk every now and then. You're like, yes. I could go for a stroll down the block.
Stroll, some jumping jacks, some good old dancing in my living room, whatever it takes. So, well, that's a podcast.
Yeah, that's a podcast. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Thank you, Lori, as always, for joining. Thank you, Dave, for joining as our very special guest. Thank you, producer Gabe, who is silently judging us behind his Zoom screen. I hear you, Dave. Gabe, I hear you judging. I can feel it.
Anyway.
Through the internet.
Thank you, nonetheless.
Yeah. But thank you, nonetheless, for editing these rambles. And of course, most importantly, thank you to you all for listening to Food Crush. Keep cooking.